It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. All-Star Panel Day, Hour 2. We're going to get to that. Our good friend Scott Dworkin of the Democratic Coalition. Rich Ojeda from No Dem Left Behind. And, of course, Sarah Burris, our outstanding reporter from Raw Story. I'm going to bang around the top stories of the week. But going to start with the infrastructure bill. Yesterday, you had Joe Manch come out and say, not going above $1.5 trillion, not going to happen. Granted, this is the guy who voted to bail the banks out and shovel cash into their trough. But when working people need something, oh, contraire, mon frere, not going to happen. So $1.5 trillion is where his number is. Joe Biden came out today and said, how about two? So we've gone from six to three and a half to two. Probably going to get one. Might get one and a half. And I say, look, you know, honestly, you know, given that scenario, you got to take it. You take it and you run. Problem. Giant problem. Senator Dipsy Do. Kyrsten Sinema evidently heading back to Arizona. You know, we're in the middle of this. Hey, we're supposed to, you know, get this stuff passed because it would be really great if we could, oh, I don't know, start rolling some of this stuff out to get some stuff done, you know, before next year begins. No, she's going back to Arizona. A little fundraising to do. Now, I'm not saying that she doesn't have a foot problem. I'm not saying that her doctor isn't in Arizona, but it seems kind of convenient, claims the foot thing, but really, really it's the fundraiser. And it's her big mega gala. It's how politicians are influenced. I'm not going to say bought and sold. It's how they're influenced. So this is very important to her. Got to go back and fill the coffers. Again, never mind the things that we need. And the thing that bothers me is it's overwhelmingly popular. I've yet to find someone who goes, you know, we really don't need to expand Medicare anymore. No, seniors have it too good. You know, those drugs that they have to buy at full price. The fact that there aren't, you know, things for dental and vision and for hearing. Things that we could expand and should have expanded years ago. No, can't do that. No, can't get early childhood education for children. Overwhelmingly popular. Community college paid for. Really, really popular. Nope, can't do any of those things. It's all bad. Paid family medical leave. Can't get any of that done. The social safety net stuff that we've been needing for 40 years. The things that have been eviscerated by the right and the con movement. This is, for me, kind of a little reset. A little bit of going, hey, you know what? We really haven't taken care of our people. We really haven't provided that floor. And one of the things for me is I look at, I'm a labor guy, and I'm never going to shy away from that. The first thing that I say is, you know, how do we create good family-sustaining wage jobs for workers so that they can support their families, they can participate in an economy? And I believe, you know, good, strong union jobs are the way to go. And doing that with government investment. If the private sector refuses to create enough of those family-sustaining jobs or cannot, I go with refuses, then the public sector has to step in. Because we cannot have the kind of desperation that we're seeing. We can't. We can't have the two Americas that John Edwards talked about in 2004, where you have one America doing really, really well, thank you very much, and everybody else who, well, not so much. And for me, this is kind of that policy that's going to get us moving in a direction to where we're going to shore up the bottom a little bit, give them a little boost, maybe help them along, change our economy in really sound, smart ways, some investments in the future on climate change, do some things that are going to help us, oh, I don't know, not roast in 50 years or not, you know, end up having beachfront property here in Pennsylvania. I don't know, maybe some smart things like that. And some of this is in there. Doesn't go far enough for me. I would love to have seen some other things, but I understand. I understand compromise. I understand, you know, some things are just a bridge too far. And Joe Manchin's been that guy who's been squawking all along. It's just too much. It wasn't too much to bail out the banks, but it's too much to bail out we the people. You go back to that era, the banks got bailed out, we got sold out. Okay, deep breath, move forward. Got to get something done. I think Manchin is gonna come along. I don't know about Sinema. I don't know the calculus there. I don't know the point that she's trying to make by just being the fly in the ointment. Or maybe that's just it. Or maybe there's really something kooky going on that well, we need to figure out. Remember, this is someone who said just 10 years ago that raising taxes on the very wealthy was common sense. Making them pay their fair share was common sense, not class warfare. And yet here we are saying, well, you know, we can't repair our infrastructure and do the bipartisan things that she wants and help people and the human infrastructure side of things that people need. Can't do both, according to her. Remember, this is a woman who said, hey, we the rich should pay their taxes, common sense. And understand, the way we pay for this is pretty simple. You tax the rich. Now, I digress a bit, because, you know, when we were paying our bills, when we were investing in the nation, when college educations were more affordable, you didn't have a lifetime of student loan debts, when things were better. And you ask any older person to, you know, opine when the moment the America was great. And they always point back to the Norman Rockwell era. They always point back to the Eisenhower era. They point back to those times and go, yeah, leave it to Beaver, one family income, supporting a family, still able to do all the things of the American middle class, a little picket fence, had their house, vacations, car in the driveway. It's great, mom making cookies. In high heels, wearing pearls, probably didn't happen much, but it was a great image. It was beautiful. It's Americana. That's what people think back to, and that ain't where we are now. But you go back to that era, and the top marginal tax rate in this country was 92%, which meant the rich guy, the Bezos, he was in the 92% tax bracket, which meant he probably did pay in the mid-60s. As opposed to the absolute zeros. So do you kind of see where the money went? Yeah, we created the wealthiest man in the world by foregoing investments in our future, foregoing investments in our health, foregoing investments in our kids' educations. And all Biden is saying is, let's move a little bit, not a lot. Trust me, this is not a lot. This is not where I would go. But Biden would raise that tax rate up just a little bit. Just a little bit. Not again, not as much as I would. Just a little bit. He would raise the top corporate tax rate from the current 21%. Because remember, Trump dropped it all the way down from 35 down to 21. He wants to boost it not back to 35 where it should be, but to 28. Now understand, when it was 35%, the effective rate was only 14. So when they dropped it down to 21, it dipped even lower. Why? Because rich people, no matter how hard they have to fight, if they can get out of paying a dime, they're going to do it. And this is where, you know, Biden is saying, we can pay for all this stuff. We can pay for this stuff. We can end the Trump tax cuts. That'd be $700 billion. We could change the corporate tax rate, another $727 billion. We could do something with inheritance taxes, $430 billion. We could do all this stuff. We could make, you know, we could have something of a wealth tax, make the ultra wealthy, not just the wealthy, But the really ones, the ones who, during the pandemic, you know, those 600 certified billionaires who pocketed almost $2 trillion just during that period, if you just made them pay 2 cents in wealth tax on everything over $50 million, we could bring in $3 trillion. But no, we can't do that. If we got the IRS to go after the tax cheats, you know, those folks at the top who have armies of tax avoidance lawyers that they then get to write off the costs of. Think about that for a second. They get to do their criming. They get to do their sleuthing, and we pay for it. They say you could raise another $1 trillion. You could easily pay for everything that we need to get done. And I don't say want, because we need it. We need to shore up a social safety net. And you see it in the unrest that is going on around us. I don't know if you've noticed, and I'll tell you, I'm very excited about it. The fact that workers have had enough. There are strikes going on across this country that I haven't seen in 25 years. You've got nurses across this country and other healthcare workers across this country, you know, going out on strike. In California, they're about ready to go on strike with 24,000 Kaiser Permanente nurses and associates. That could happen. You've got, you know, hundreds of healthcare workers in other places, and, you know, who are about to or are on strike in this moment. Massachusetts, Illinois. In a bit, we're going to talk to people in Buffalo, New York. You got the motion picture industry, some 60,000 people who are, they're right there, right about to go on strike. You've got carpenters, you've got transit workers, you've got public sector workers, you've got people who work in dining rooms on college campuses are finally saying, you know what, enough already. 10,000 John Deere workers. I mean, this is the year of the strike because people are, they've had enough. Here's my problem, though. These are the organized workers. These are the people who, the small, small percentage of organized workers. Understand, across this country, only a little over 6% of workers in the private sector in this country are unionized. A little over 6%. That means there's like 93, 94% of us that are not. And we don't have the protections of a union to go on strike. We don't have the ability to demand better wages, hours, conditions by hitting that picket line. We're being abused in silence. So when I see a story like the one that came out today on Amazon, because you may remember, Amazon fired two whistleblowers. This Emily Cunningham and Marin Costa. For having the audacity to say that they weren't doing enough on climate change. They were doing some things and talking out about what the company wasn't or doing, and they were organizing people within the company to try and get them to do the right thing. Also to, well, you know, maybe do a little protecting of the workers as well, just a thought. So they fired them. And finally, now after all this time, and it's been well over a year, in fact, if you remember, they had a... one of the executives at Amazon who quit because he's like, well, I can't stand by and allow these whistleblowers to be fired without there being repercussions. And he left. And good on him. Finally, the NLRB has come out and ruled that, yes, Amazon did fire these workers illegally. They're going to pay them back pay and the real punishment. Here it comes. You ready for it? This is the real punishment. The back pay, that's one thing. And if these two women had gotten a job in the interim, if they went and worked anywhere else, if they did anything, cut grass, washed windows, washed dogs, took in laundry, any of that, it'll be deducted because it's only what you lost. And the real hard part, the real punishment, they were going to have to post a notice that they won't do it again. That's the freaking punishment. That's it. I'm sorry, we won't do it again. Until next time. Until the time after that. Until the time after that. Until the time after that. And they get away with this because there's no punishment here. There's nothing here. So if these two women went and got jobs making the exact same wage somewhere else, because they're very bright and well-educated and good at what they do, Amazon would have to pay them a whopping nothing. Kind of like Jeff Bezos pays in taxes. And the only real punishment is not even a slap on the wrist. It's a post a notice. You know, on that board with all of your rights about the ability to, get minimum wage that no one ever sees. Yeah, that's where they're going to put it, right next to the billboard nobody ever looks at. They're going to post a notice. Oh, we're sorry. We didn't mean to get caught. We won't do it again until the next time. And if we do, we'll post another one of these notices because this is so hard for us. These are the penalties. And this is why I say, look, the reality is we've got broken laws. So while we're talking about infrastructure, while we're talking about, you know, the just the insanity in Congress and our ability to get nothing done, I keep saying labor law reform is something we need in the worst way. Major, massive, comprehensive labor law reform that give workers the ability to stand up and fight back and demand better wages, hours, conditions, like these thousands of workers, tens of thousands of workers across this country are doing today and will be doing in the coming days. And I say, good, it's about time. We need more of it. We need more people joining unions. We need more people going on strike and demanding better wages, hours, conditions, and with it, for everybody, a better standard of living. For me, that's the part. This is how we raise the boat. It's not the water. The rising tide lifts all boats. No, no. The rising tide? No. The striking workers, they're the ones who lift the boat. And we need more of it. And what happens then? I had an old timer tell me this years and years ago. He goes, it didn't matter. Every 10 years we went on strike for one reason, to get people to walk off the job, cross that onto that picket line and fight for something. Because the second they were on that picket line and they fought for something, they won something, they're never going to give it up. It's too easy to give up stuff you didn't fight for. And this is why I'm thrilled to see so many of these people out in the street saying, you know what? We're tired of the crummy working conditions. We're tired of the abuse. We're tired of the poverty wages. We're tired of the diminishing health care and the non-existent retirement security. We are tired and we've had enough. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's going on up in Buffalo, New York, as some 2,500 nurses and healthcare workers have taken to the picket line. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day Americans awoke to fears the nationwide steel strike would spread rapidly to include key fabrication plants. 500,000 steel workers had joined 400,000 coal miners on strike the morning before. The miners resolved to defend their $100 a month pension, instituting what John L. Lewis called the No Day Work Week, emboldened the steel workers to walk out of the mills. Within 24 hours, 96% of all steel production in the country was completely shut down. United Steelworker contracts were due to expire on the 15th, but the writing was on the wall. The mill owners decried anything close to mine pensions as nothing short of socialistic and refused to budge in negotiations. United Steelworkers President Phil Murray thundered that those companies that failed to agree to demands for non-contributory pensions and insurance would be shut down. But militants warned that President Truman's fact-finding board had already watered down strike demands. The president's board had been established to put off two previous strike deadlines. The guidelines it issued only encouraged steel magnates to stand tough against United Steelworker demands. These included a 30-cent raise plus increased company insurance and pension contributions. Now, it had become a defensive struggle over whether steelworkers would have to begin contributing to health and and pension plans through wage cuts. By the time steelworkers ended their strike 42 days later, they had won the $100 a month pension minus what they would receive from Social Security, and they had to begin contributing to a health insurance plan with no wage increase at all. Still, workers celebrated that they had successfully defended the United Steelworkers against the all-out union-busting drive. Here at the Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor, and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's being reported some 700,000. We've broken the 700,000 barrier right now of people who have died from COVID. We're seeing hospitals across the country overrun, ICUs across the country overrun. And what I guess we've forgotten that frontline hero stuff, the healthcare heroes, the essentials. We've forgotten all of that because the desperate conditions, the poverty wages, all that stuff seems to be back front and center. And as I said earlier, the reality is you've got enough people are saying, you know what, we have had enough. We're taking to the streets, and that's why this morning at 6 a.m. you had healthcare workers. Remember, our frontline heroes at Mercy Hospital in Buffalo, New York, who walked off the job. I think they were trying to negotiate a contract for 18 months, and this is kind of where it's gotten to. And it's sad that the management's allowed this to happen. But here to share some thoughts on this, I've asked Josh Zupinger to come talk with us. He is an immediate treatment assistant there at the Mercy Hospital in the cardiac ICU department. Josh, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anytime.
So am I getting this right? Some 2,500 of you this morning said we're taking to the picket line?
You're absolutely correct.
And, you know, what brought you to this moment? I know 18 months of trying to negotiate. I know that's way too long, but why this? Why now?
That now was the hospital kind of left us with no other option. I mean, we have worked 18 months with next to no staff and next to no equipment to do the job that we need. We've had to use scarce resources and try to take tiny things and make it into a whole pile just to give the care that these patients deserve.
Now, you're somebody who works in the ICU, so you're seeing some of the worst stuff. And to have shortages and to have over understaffing and being overworked in that environment, I can't imagine that's any good for you or for the patient, for that matter.
No, it is. It's definitely not. I switched positions from. I was on a med surg floor for 5 years, and at the end of April, I came down to the ICU. And I've seen a lot just being down there in the few months that I've been down there.
So, and I can imagine. Look, this pandemic has been horrible on healthcare workers all across this country. Because look, we're talking with nurses and healthcare workers in Massachusetts and Illinois, all across this country, who are in the kind of the same situation that you're in. Overworked, understaffed, underpaid, all of those things, and finally going, you know what, we've hit the end of the road. We're burnt out, we're stressed out, and we're struggling, and we've had enough. Or am I going too far for you guys?
I don't think you're going too far at all. I think at some point you do have to say that enough is enough. Personally, I don't think there's a shortage of nurses. I think there's just a shortage of employers who want to treat nurses with the respect that we deserve, so that way we can give the care that these patients deserve.
Yeah, one of the things that we learned in economics class, you know, 100 years ago for me, but we learned the supply and demand thing. if you're not getting enough of something, you've got to entice them somehow. And you do that through better wages, hours, conditions. Conditions being a huge part of this, because I don't know exactly what's going on in Buffalo, but I can tell you in other hospitals, it's the working conditions more than everything else that nurses and staff are talking about. Their ability to help take care of their patients, their ability to have the materials and the personal protective gear that they need. It's that stuff more than the wages and the benefits. Am I getting this right on your side?
Yeah, I completely agree. It makes it very, very difficult to give the care that you want to give when you don't have the equipment to do it.
Now, I was doing a little background check on your CEO, Mr. Sullivan, I believe his name is. Mr. Sullivan, he gets somewhere around $1 million a year in compensation. You've got some executives somewhere around the $7 million a year range. It's curious to me that we've got these folks who run these hospitals who have these big seven-figure salaries, but we can't seem to pay the person who's doing the actual work something that they can live on. It just seems it seems not just unfair, it seems ludicrous to me.
I agree 100%. And in my eyes, having happy employees leads to financial success.
So now that you guys are on strike, and I imagine that the community is supporting you. I saw some petitions that were being circulated. I saw some really good videos of the community supporting you. I guess we should start there. What kind of support are you getting from the community?
Oh, it's been amazing. It's been amazing. I wasn't there this morning, unfortunately. I wish I could have been. But I've seen on our Facebook groups and from people that I know were there, the elementary schools are dropping off snacks and water. And I know my barber has said that he wants signs in his barber shop because he wants to support us. And it's just been amazing.
It's like any strike. Nobody wants this. Nobody wants to be on strike. People want to be at their job. They want to be doing the work that they're doing. Do you believe you were forced into this? Do you believe this is something that the hospital wanted?
Honestly, I don't think either side wanted it to happen, but I do feel as though we had no other option in order to give our patients a safe environment for them so that they can have care that they deserve. They came to the hospital to get better. Yes. They're not going to get better, and you're going to have more negative patient outcomes with little staff.
So let me ask you this. Now that you guys are on strike, they clearly brought in a bunch of travel nurses and people, basically scabs. They brought a bunch of scabs in to come and take your jobs. And I know they pay them just, well, incredible amounts. It seems to me, and it always seems to me, that this could have been avoided by just, the hospital realizing that they're going to spend probably, millions and millions of dollars on these travel scab nurses, that they could have just said, look, we're gonna work together and we're gonna move this hospital in a better direction. I just find it wasteful. I find it ridiculous. But I find it a common practice, because the reason I asked you if you felt forced into it, because other nurses are going, look, they want to break our union down. They want to push us to get the most that they can get out of us. So that's the reason I asked if you felt pushed into this, because, well, it's what the union busting playbook across this country has been.
Right. Right. And I agree. I know that they don't like the union. It's obvious they don't like the union. You can see it. You can see one hospital's non-union. Their one hospital's sisters is non-union. And they did not offer them what they offered us.
Did they offer them more or less?
I believe they offered them more. As far as I know, under my knowledge, that they did not offer them the benefits they were offering us, which we are getting considerably less. Being with the wage increase that they were giving us, offering to us, I should say, and with all the things they wanted to take away from us, we would have ended up in a negative.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Josh Zuppinger. He is a immediate treatment assistant in the cardiovascular ICU at Mercy Hospital in Buffalo, New York. They're on strike today. Some 2,500 nurses and healthcare workers, 6:30, 6 a.m. this morning, walked off the job. and went on strike after what is 18 months of bargaining. It just seems to me, Josh, that in 18 months, management would have gotten their ducks in order and would have been able to avoid this. So in your estimate, what is the sticking point here? Is it the conditions? Is it wages? Where do you see the sticking point?
For me, from what I have seen, the sticking point is definitely staffing. It's safe staffing so that way these patients can be cared for the way that they expect to be cared for when they're sick.
Yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, I years ago we had a relative who was in ICU, had lung cancer, had surgery, and I remember I had to go and sit for 2 weeks with him every day because the hospital was just that short staffed. In an ICU, you had one nurse for three patients, which what I'm told is unheard of.
It's very, very unsafe.
And I had to sit there. I had to sit there with him so that if something happened, I could go find somebody immediately. And it was that kind of thing where you go, this is unsafe. And the nurses didn't want it. They were stressed. They were overworked. But sadly, they, unlike you, didn't have a voice. They didn't have a union to speak up for them. So I'm glad that you guys are saying, look, it's staffing. It's taking care of our people. Because as I understand, you guys did a survey of all of your members. And what you came out with is, well, what was it, 70% of them have said that there are staffing shortages?
Yes.
That seems really high for a hospital that's supposed to be taking care of people during a pandemic.
It was terrible. It's been really hard. I've watched in the ICU alone in the few months that I've been down there, nurses be tripled with patients that they shouldn't have been. They should have been one-to-one nursing care, but we didn't have a choice. When I worked on a different unit, it was a 48-bed unit. I was an aide on that floor, and sometimes there'd be only two aides for 48 patients. And you'd have 24 patients that you have to do vital signs and bed baths and make sure they don't fall and answer call lights. And it's not easy.
No, that is not easy. That's insane. Because there's no way you keep up with that. I'm sorry. No matter, you look like somebody who could run really fast. I don't see you running that. I don't see you being, unless you figured out how to split molecules and be in more places than one at a time. I don't know how you keep up with that.
As much as I would love to split myself in half to keep those patients safe, it is very, very difficult.
So what's the response to the community who's going to say, Josh, well, you know, you should have gone a different route, you know, going out on the picket line. Now you're not in the hospital at all. And you're not taking care of the patients. Then what's the response to that?
My response is that if we didn't do this now, it's just going to get worse later.
Yeah, I mean, it's been 18 months. I mean, how much further down the road do you get? And I say, look, a strike, nobody wants a strike. It's the last arrow in the quiver. But at some point, you need to jumpstart the discussions. So are there any plans from this point forward for more discussions, for getting back with management to get people back, the qualified people who do the job back into the hospital?
Absolutely. That's the one thing we want. We want to be the ones in there giving our community and our patients the care that we know that we can give them, that we only us can give them.
Now, it seems to me, in looking at some of the numbers about this hospital, it seems like on the monetary front that they're doing okay, that this is not a poor hospital. They're not crying poverty, or they're crying poverty, but they're really not. Am I getting that?
Correct.
So this seems to me to be one of those moments where it's really about the will. It's really about their power over your power. And this is kind of one of those moments that going to have to work itself out.
I agree.
When you were
justice on the will prevail, the right thing will happen. I think the right thing that will happen is safe staffing ratios. I hope so.
And at least look, I hope so. At some point, we're all going to have to go to the hospital. Everybody eventually ends up there once in their lifetime. And what we want is the best possible care from people who are well-trained, well-rested, well-educated, and passionate about their work. I never want somebody jabbing me with a needle, Josh, who hasn't slept in 24 hours, who was hopped up on coffee or 5-hour energy drinks. I want no part of that. And who's worried about the beeper beeping in 15 different directions. This is not a healthcare system. This is a crisis waiting to happen. And this is something that has to be stopped. And it's good on you guys for being the ones to speak up and say, we've got to change these things.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And my theory is, in order to enact change, it takes action.
So last line of questioning I've got for you, because your coworkers, obviously strikes are about keeping people united on the same page, moving in the same direction. You got everybody out today?
Yep, they're out there full force today.
And the concept of one day longer, because, you know, I've been talking to the nurses up in Massachusetts who have been on strike since March, and they're as committed as they were back in March. Because you know, once you start down this path, you got to see it through, right?
You always. Anything you do in life, you have to see it through to the end.
So I know it's early in this, but are you guys setting up ways to help have people help fund a strike fund, a benefit fund, to make sure that you guys are going to be able to make this down the road?
That question I don't actually know the answer to. I'm not part of the financial involvement with it.
Right. No, the hope is that there's some movement in that way, because ultimately this comes down to people being able to put food on the table and a roof over their head. So, you know, when I talk about strikes, sure, I talk about it from the perspective of you, Josh, and the working people who are out on that picket line, because they're not getting a paycheck. They've still got rent to pay. They've still got food to put on the table. They still got to get clothes on the kids' back and all of that, sugar and shoes and all of that, without paychecks coming in. So in order to help take care of our patients, to help fight for a better healthcare system, we got to make sure that your kids can eat.
Correct. And I know the union does have, they have a strike fund that they do pay us. After 14 days of being on strike, they will start to pay us in order to keep their members afloat in life.
It's something
so
we absolutely
can continue to fight the good fight.
Something we most certainly need. And hopefully this is very short. Like all of these strikes, I say, you know, you make your point. You hope they get the message. You get back to the table. You hammer something out. You get a good agreement that you can hold your head up because you won something, and then you continue to hold on to that and you fight for it. Because as I said earlier, I think more workers need to go on strike to fight for better benefits, better wages, better conditions, better opportunities, and then hold on to them. So I wish you guys nothing but the best. And as this continues, I'd love to have you guys come back and keep us up to date on what's going on and keep us up on what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I, like I said, anytime, I am more than willing, any day.
Good stuff, Josh. I appreciate the time. Josh Zupinger, like I said, he works in the ICU there at Buffalo Mercy Hospital. And look, honestly, I think it takes such great courage, especially in this moment, to step forward and say, you know what? I'm going to put myself in peril to help the people who need it the most. Because, you know, like I said, we've talked to healthcare workers across this country, and the things that they see, the stories that they tell, the conditions under which they have to work, I don't think anyone should have to. And fortunately, these people in Buffalo have got a voice, and they are using it. And I hope folks will check out their website, and we'll get links out on social media on how we can do that, and we can get more information out on this. It's safestaffingbuffalo.org, the website, and we'll get that out here over social media. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1851. That was the day that William Henry, a black cooper or barrel maker who went by the name of Jerry, was arrested in Syracuse, New York. He was first told that he was being arrested for theft, but then he learned that federal marshals had arrested him for violating the Fugitive Slave Act passed the year before. Jerry had escaped slavery in Missouri. The Anti-Slavery Liberty Party was holding its convention in a nearby church. When word came about Jerry's arrest, a crowd rushed to release him. Once released, he was quickly recaptured and returned to custody. But then a large crowd, numbering more than 2,000, gathered to free Jerry from the office where he was being held. According to research done by the Syracuse University Library, the first person into the office was J.M. Clapp, an iron worker likely chosen for his brawn. The crowd was able to free Jerry and hide him until he could escape into Canada. Clapp also had to flee to Canada to avoid arrest along with 8 others. 19 people were indicted for participating in the rescue. Only one person was ever convicted, and he died before he could appeal. In turn, the abolitionists won an indictment against the marshal who had arrested Jerry. They charged him with kidnapping. Although the marshal was acquitted, it gave the abolitionists a chance to publicly challenge the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act. Each year until 1858, a Jerry Rescue celebration commemorated the event. Abolitionists referred to the, quote, Jerry level as a standard for justice. In 2001, a monument to the rescue was dedicated in Clinton Square in downtown Syracuse. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in 2 segments. And you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, like I said, you know, good on those nurses in Buffalo and the healthcare workers there. I wish them the best, and we're going to keep following that because I think this is really important stuff. I do. I think it's important that that workers finally find their voice and say enough already, and that unions are saying no, we're gonna be more willing to go on strike for a couple reasons. One, there was all that pent up demand during the former guy, and you've got Joe Biden, who is in my view the most pro-union president at least of my lifetime. So you've got the conditions are right. And like I said, look, you know, I remember this, the old timer who said, you need to cross that threshold. You need to take that moment. And I remember when I went on strike in 94, there was that moment of leaving the workplace and going, I may never come back here. I am walking across this threshold. I am going to fight for something. And who knows? They may close the doors. They may fire us all. Who knows what they may. But here we are all these years later, 94 to today. And the reason we went on strike was not because of our paychecks. It was to make sure that a certain job wasn't made permanently part-time. And those jobs today are good, family-sustaining, good union jobs with good wages, good benefits, good opportunities. And they're full-time jobs. They wanted to create these two-tier wage systems, and they wanted a whole bunch of part-timers, and they wanted all this stuff for flexibility. And the union said no. The workers said no. We're going to stand up and fight for our brothers and sisters. We're going to make sure that our kids have jobs. We're going to make sure down the road these are still good family-sustaining wage jobs. That's what we need to do across the spectrum in every job, because that's how you raise conditions. That's how you raise standards of living. not by wishing and hoping and praying and going, oh, will the benevolent company leak something down on me? Will the river of golden honey finally flow? No, it doesn't happen. It only happens when you demand and when you're willing to walk out onto that picket line, and good on them. My thought for today, vaccine mandates, they are working. So much working. And there's an unintended consequence to this. You know, look, I want people to be safe. I want people to be healthy. I want to get past this pandemic. But the unintended consequence is brilliant. We are weeding out teachers who don't believe in science, nurses who don't believe in medicine, and cops who don't believe in protecting, let alone serving. Win, win, win. Kind of like the vaccine hat trick. And the thing is you know, I talk to numerous people right now, friends, who go, you know, I go to my Facebook feed and I'm weeding out the kooks that were my friends. I never knew this person was crazy. Wow, this person too, got to get rid of them. We are now finding out who the cranks, the crackpots, and the kooks are. That's a good thing. This is a good moment. This is going to give us the ability to one, identify. Because look, I don't want an anti-science person teaching my kid, voodoo. I definitely don't want someone in medicine who go, no, here, take some snake oil. Oh no, beet juice will take care of that. Here, ram silver up your derriere. No, I don't want that. I want somebody who, when I go to a doctor, who's going to understand medicine. If I want voodoo or witchcraft, I'll find a circus somewhere. Maybe I'll find the one I never bought the candle from. But, you know, now we're finding out who the crazy people really are. And the weird thing for me is the Supreme Court. The thing today, Justice Sonia Sotomayor allowed the vaccine mandate to stay in place. And you may remember, you know, Amy COVID Barrett, she kind of did a similar thing back in August when she rejected a request to block Indiana University's vaccine mandate. This is eye-opening moments. To where someone like Barrett, who I see as one of the kind of, you know, the voodoo folks, saying, no, this is actual science. This gives me hope. And maybe this is now even in the workplace where you get some of the crackpots out. Because as I've said from the beginning, capitalism will decide. If we're not smart enough to do it on our own, if we're incapable of ruling ourselves, capitalism will decide. The free market will weed them out. And we're seeing this across the country, and they're huge news stories, which is just mind-blowing to me. You know, 175 people fired from this system of 35,000. And that's the headline, 175 people fired. Not that overwhelmingly 99% of the people are doing the right thing, but you got these handful of kooks that, good, bye. Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you. Good luck. Go do something else. But I do find the unintended consequences interesting. Now, I had someone tell me that, you know, Joe Biden, he planned this. And this person was coming at me with the idea that this would be a negative. And I said, if Joe Biden truly did foresee this, if he is that kind of visionary leader, if he has that kind of crystal ball that goes, oh, you know what? If we mandate the vaccine, we can get rid of kooks and crackpots. I am so glad I voted for him. I'd vote for him twice if I could figure out how to, but not going to say that because Doug Mastriano is in our listening district, and he would be the one, see, radio host says vote twice. No, vote legally. This is the kind of quackery we need to get past, folks. And I'm really kind of in this place where I'm tired of insanity. You know, we talk back about, you know, the greatest generation. I think of my grandparents' generation. I think of those folks who would they have put up with this? You know, would they have allowed, you know, a handful? I know what my grandfather would have done. And this is one of those things. My grandfather didn't play around. You know, even in his 50s, he'd grab you by the throat. Because that's what their generation did. I got to think. It was one of these moments I had of thinking about him. If someone would have come up to him and pulled a mask off his face, I can't imagine what he would have done other than basically rip their head off. We're not that society anymore. And look, I'm not advocating violence, but when someone is aggressive to you in such a way that is going to put your health at risk, and be it, you know, pulling your mask off, being it, entering your personal space and breathing on you deliberately, on an airplane, doing the kind of insanity that we've been seeing in these stores where, you know, people are just trying to work, in these restaurants where people are just trying to make a living, just trying to get through this, to have the kind of childish, immature, selfish, narcissistic, idiotic behavior that these children, these petulant children keep displaying. I don't know how that generation would have acted other than there'd be a lot of people being made citizens out of. Because my grandfather's number one statement was always, sometimes you got to knock somebody upside the back of the head to make a citizen out of them. And that was that generation. Our generation's very soft. We want to convince people. We want people to do their research. Knowing that most people in this country don't have research skills. Most people, you know, when they did a research paper in high school, what did they do? They opened up the encyclopedia or they went to Google and, you know, typed in the thing and they basically plagiarized what they saw on that one page. And that is research. So when I hear people go, well, you got to do your research. What research? What sources? You know, this is one of the things I try and teach my kids. You know, when you're doing your research, it shouldn't be some dimwit on YouTube. It should be a peer reviewed study where other people take it apart. And then it has to be defended. For me, that's a big part of this. It has to be a credible source. Not Joe's blog. Not, hey, I had some wings and now I'm going to belch something out. But actual peer-reviewed research. And this is why I think what LeBron did was a real, while I thought it was a good thing that he came out and said, hey, I got vaccinated, and maybe that's going to be something that will be seen, especially in the African-American community, which I'll tell you, if I were a black guy, I would be a little hesitant. I would, given the history of what we've done to black men in this country. I'd be a little hesitant. Which is why you need to have people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who basically come out and said, you got to do this. There's no screwing around here. What's wrong with you? But we're in this moment where we can either rise to the challenge, as our greatest generation did, or we can continue to rip ourselves apart and continue to allow a vocal, well-funded minority to keep things really screwed up for quite some time. I'm hoping, like I said, hoping we're able to get something positive moved through, hoping we're able to do something that's going to help us move in the right direction. But I'm not overly thrilled. I'm not overly convinced just yet. I'm a little concerned about where we are as a country. Because this shouldn't be controversial. Shouldn't be. Protecting yourself, protecting your children, protecting your family, protecting your neighbors, having respect for your neighbors. You know, I remember the guy I talked to a week and a half or two ago. Basically saying, you know, I'm not going to get the vaccine because I can't. I've got some issues, and I respect that. But he said, look, I'm doing everything I can possibly do to keep myself and everybody around me safe while still living my life. And I know that I'm putting my wife and my kids at risk. I know I'm putting my neighbors at risk. And I'm trying to be as responsible as I can possibly be. You come at me with something like that, I respect that. You say, hey, look, I'm cognizant of the risks that I'm possibly putting into this environment. And do it in a way without screaming this weird entitlement. I mean, I love some of these women walking into Froyo or some yogurt joint and going, I have a medical exemption. just crazy. Just insane where we are. But here we are. The country has reached 700,000 dead. Yesterday we said that Montana had reached 150% of their ICU capacity. Congratulations, Montana. And now we're finding out that other places are as well. You've got, the fact, the Midwest is getting hit. Vaccination rates in those parts are still lagging, and the South still lagging. There are a lot of problems. We've had record numbers of deaths, being recorded. In Texas, things are still going up. And still yet, we're averaging more than 2,000 people dying a day. Where I live in Pennsylvania, we've seen, a 7-day high of, 370 people dying over the 7 days. And you go, but what's the big deal? That's such a small number. No, globally, we're still talking about, in the United States and globally, we're still talking about COVID being one of the leading causes of death. We're still talking about, some really, really terrible stuff. We're still looking at this in weird ways. And in fact, what Reuters has said is the United States is leading the world in COVID cases. According to them, 19% of all deaths are in the country are due related to COVID. How weird is that? And as we fill up the hospitals, as we fill up the ICUs, as we do the other things, other people die. That's the struggle. And that's always been the problem. So for me, the hope is in this moment, maybe find a little bit of that reason, a little bit of that respect, a little bit of that understanding, and protect yourself, protect your friends, your family, your neighbors, protect your community. And ultimately, maybe we get past this. I've said it before. I hate wearing a mask. I'm about ready to fly here soon. Next week we're taking half of the week off, and the entire following week for our vacation week. And we're going to Alaska for, I'm giving a speech and doing some stuff for Teamsters Local 959 in Anchorage, and can't wait to see the good folks there in Anchorage. We're going to be off. And the hope is during that time that we're going to be there, no one gets sick, no one gets infected. The flights go reasonably well without having anyone being duct taped to a seat, that everyone can be big boys and girls and sit in their seats quietly and trek 13 hours across the country without insanity, without incident, without crazy, and do it with some respect and some reason. I'm hoping, still really hopeful. But that is exactly where things are. But while we're gone, love to hear your thoughts. You can email us, rick@therickSmithShow.com. We'll still be putting out some of our best of, some of the best interviews, some of the best conversations that we've had over the last couple of weeks. If there's something you particularly want to hear, some folks that you said, hey, that was a great guest, be sure to let us know. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.